The philosophical question is, at what point does enough speculation become too much? The short-term outlook for gas is that it's being driven by competing narratives. And narratives are very important because the way that gas prices are formed on these very liquid trading hubs means that sentiment is driving the way that prices move as much as like the fundamentals of supply and demand. So for every molecule of gas that I burn at home on my stove, that molecule of gas has been bought and sold on average 17 or 18 times before it's delivered to me. And every participant is looking to get value from that trade. So that inflates the price. The fundamentals are bearish because for the reasons I explained, you know, the renewables explosion in Europe and the UK included is, you know, it's really kind of pulling the rug out from underneath the demand story. But on the supply side, there's huge uncertainty.
Hello and welcome back to Transmission. Gas prices are often linked to power prices across the globe. But what sets the price of gas and how are increasing levels of renewable generation affecting this? This week, Quentin is joined by Seb Kennedy, founding editor at Energy Flux. The conversation covers natural gas, from extraction, transportation to pricing, gas demand trends in Europe, the drivers of price volatility, and how speculation is driving market prices. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a review wherever you listen. Let's jump in.
Seb, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get started, I mean, if you're listening to this, this is going to be an awesome episode. Seb comes from, he's got his own firm, Energy Flux or Energy Flux News. And if you're on your phone listening to this, find Seb on LinkedIn or Twitter and check out the Substack. This is going to be all about gas markets. And on this podcast, we haven't really done this before in the depth that it deserves. And power markets are so linked and reliant on gas markets. And we have Seb in, who knows everything there is to know about these markets and has been covering them for a long, long time. Seb, so first question, how did you get into this gas thing? And why is this your mastermind subject?
So I'm an energy journalist by training and been writing about energy since about 2008. Started off on the kind of renewables beats in the UK, and I've written for a whole host of publications and organisations. I spent 4 years at a natural gas management consultancy editing a daily news feed for the gas and liquefied natural gas industries. And then I branched out on my own and started Energy Flux and took a lot of my learnings about the gas markets into that publication. And that's where I publish all of my kind of data-driven investigative research into what's happening in gas markets.
And when we're talking about gas, this is just to set the record straight before we go any, we're going to go right down the rabbit hole, but we're going to start quite zoomed out. So when we're talking about gas, what is gas?
Natural gas is mostly methane, and it's generally produced by drilling a hole in the ground and pumping up what's in a reservoir, often mixed crude oil and natural gas, and there are other kind of gases and liquids down there too. And when I was at the natural gas consultancy, then I remember there was a phrase that used to do the rounds, which was that if you're prospecting for oil and you find gas, and this is very kind of macho male way to phrase it, they said if you find gas, it was like kissing your sister, because none of the oil guys wanted to find gas. Gas was worthless, pretty much worthless at the wellhead. Everybody wanted oil. That was where all the big margins were. And when you drill for gas, you find gas, it's a problem, because it's like, oh, you've got to build pipeline infrastructure, you've got to find a market for it, you've got to have compressors, and you know, you've got to have processing facilities. And then when you get it to consumers, it's still like the margins are absolutely tiny. So gas was always conventionally among the upstream operators seen as like a very low value, almost like a waste product. And that's changed in recent years.
So now gas is so fundamental to energy markets or just an industry or survival as a species now. What's the structure of the global, this is a bit of a silly question, but what's the structure of the global gas market, or what is the market for gas internationally?
So I think the fact that it's international is interesting, because it never used to be. It used to be very much a localized market. Molecules were drilled out of the ground. You know, they were they were sold to end consumers only as far as the gas transmission network, the pipelines would stretch. And so you had very different pricing regimes going from, say, like between North America and other parts of the world, because the supply demand dynamics were very different and there was nothing connecting them. Over, you know, since the kind of 1970s, and we've seen a very gradual and then a very rapid increase in the trade of liquefied natural gas. So this is gas that has been produced in the conventional way, drilled out of the ground, but instead of just being piped to consumers, it gets piped into a liquefaction plant. And this is basically a very, very big refrigerator. And what it does is it uses energy to work like a fridge to condense and cool down the gas to about, I think it's like minus 170 degrees centigrade. And that condenses it into liquid form. So you can actually, like, many orders of magnitude more gas into the same amount of space. And you can pump it then onto a cryogenic vessel. So that's just basically a big boat that has cryogenic walls on it.
And these ships are gigantic, aren't they?
They're massive, yes. They're growing as well. They've been growing with the industry. So the ships themselves have grown as the size of the liquefaction plants have grown. And of course, with the widening of things like the Panama Canal, which allows bigger boats to go through. So you can get, it's very common now to get an LNG vessel that can hold significantly more than 160,000 cubic meters of liquefied natural gas.
And what's remarkable is now that you can trade, now there's a global gas market with LNG carriers, that you can have countries and territories that have got no gas on their shores that can have a economy that's highly reliant or dependent on gas. And that's just absolutely fascinating. So where does the gas come from then? Well, around the world, if we were sat here with a globe, where would you point to as the areas where the gas comes from?
Yeah, so the major producing and exporting regions of gas are North America, the Middle East, East Coast of Africa increasingly is producing more. Australia is a massive producer of gas, although a lot of it comes from coal bed methane, which is a slightly different way of getting the gas out the ground. And like Europe was traditionally a big producer of natural gas from the North Sea, but those reserves are increasingly depleted, and particularly here in the UK, it's very much into its twilight years.
And so we should probably clarify a few things because we're going to talk about it a lot. So when you extract gas from the ground, well, what's the shale thing? And what's fracking? And what's the coal bed methane? And can you just cover a few of those terms so we know where we stand with them? Because in some areas, you drill into the ground, not too deep, and you get high pressure, beautiful, sweet gas without a load of sulfur in it. And in other areas, you have to compress it or you have to frack it. And there's lots of different ways to do it. Could we just cover the production bit in a high level first? Because it affects production costs, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Yeah. So let's just focus on the two main sources of gas, which is like conventional reservoirs and shale gas that's procured through hydraulic fracturing. So yeah, conventional gas would be found often mixed up with crude oil in a reservoir under the ground, and you drill a borehole into the ground and then you pump it up and you separate it from the oil and you treat it. And then you put it through the kind of compression system and it goes through pipelines to wherever it's going to go. Shale gas is fundamentally different. This is gas that's much more dispersed and it's kind of held in shale formations, shale rock formations. And you can't just drill a single well and pump it up because it's actually almost not really frozen, but it's kind of like a bit like Han Solo in Star Wars when he's kind of frozen in rock, you know, he's like, it's a little bit like that. Maybe not the best analogy, but essentially, like, imagine rock with those little bubbles of methane kind of captured in there. To get those out, you can't drill a single well. You have to drill down into the shale formation in more than one location and then drill horizontally and then pump down into the borehole a mixture of fluids, very high pressure, and they crack the rock. And that fracturing, like you're using hydraulic pressure to fracture the rock, that then frees these methane and other molecules that are caught in the rock. And they're absorbed by this liquid, I think it's called proppant. And then you pump that liquid back up to the surface and you can then pull the methane out of, or the natural gas out of that liquid, and process it, and then, you know, you can then mix it with any other kind of gas source once you've got the kind of basic components of natural gas.
Now, can we talk about some prices and some terms? So who's this Henry Hub guy?
Henry Hub is it's actually a physical trading hub in the state of Louisiana, I believe. And it's a confluence of pipelines that bring together production from a variety of gas producing basins around the US Gulf Coast. And so it's a place where you can buy and sell gas from different producing regions. And there's a kind of aggregate price. So it's like a trading hub. It's a physical trading hub, but it's also kind of evolved into a kind of a more financialized trading hub. And you can buy, you know, futures on Henry Hub. So you can speculate on the price of gas in the future, you know, from between now and like a month's time, 6 months, next season, next year. You can even trade Henry Hub into the 2030s. There is a price for Henry Hub today for delivery in 2032, I think.
At the hub. Well, we should probably figure out pricing. So what's a unit of gas? And well, in the power markets, everybody knows what a megawatt hour is, but it's a bit more complicated than that in gas, isn't it? So what is a unit of gas? And there's a physical element to it, a geographical element, isn't there? And then how is it priced?
Yeah. So in the US and increasingly around the world, then gas is priced in million British thermal units. And that's a function of the energy content of the gas. That changes according to location. So in the US on the Gulf Coast, where you have just this enormous supply base of shale, they're swimming in gas, then the gas is very cheap because there's a big supply and there's a limited amount of demand. So the price is very low. It's structurally low. So, you know, price of gas on Henry Hub is generally between like $2 and $4 per MMBTU. But if you go to importing regions like Europe, like Asia, well, at the moment, it's, you know, double digits MMBTU, so like 10 of 10, 12, 13, 14 MMBTU. And so that spread between the two basins is an opportunity for traders who can buy gas at Henry Hub price, liquefy it in one of those big fridges, put it on a big cryogenic vessel, float it across the Atlantic and offload at a regasification terminal in the UK, in Europe, or on the other side of the world, in Japan, in China, and then sell at the local price in the importing market. And then they get to keep the difference minus the cost of transportation and liquefaction.
Wow. So European gas is 3 or 4, maybe even 5 times the price as American shale or Texan shale. That has a big impact on the competitiveness of industry in those regions, right? If your baseload energy is so much cheaper in one area than another. Can we talk about LNG for a second? Because this LNG thing has just grown and grown and grown. And especially since the moving away from Russian gas and how LNG has, so Europe moved away from Russian gas for obvious reasons. And American shale, the miracle of American shale, just came in and plugged the gap. And it seems like LNG terminals and shipbuilding, and it's like this ever-growing LNG world. So how much of global gas is LNG now compared to pipeline gas? And what are the fundamentals or the structures are within the LNG market?
Yeah, so it's interesting, actually. If you go back about 3 or 4 years, I think, then imagine all the gas that is bought and sold in the world, we went from having maybe 55% of it was sold by pipeline, so in its gaseous form, and then increasingly it shifted towards LNG. And about two or three years ago, then it actually tipped in favor of LNG. So now more gas, of all the gas that's traded in the world, most of it, a small majority of it, is sold as liquefied natural gas. So LNG is now the primary trading vector for natural gas in the world.
Wow. So yeah, if you turn your hob on, more likely than not, anywhere around the world, it's been liquefied at some point.
Yeah, but not in North America, because they don't import LNG. Although, of course, they were importing LNG, and the shale revolution completely turned that on its head. Like, you know, the US, some of the first liquefaction export plants on the US Gulf Coast were originally import terminals. The US was, quote unquote, running out of gas because the conventional fields were all declining. But then when the shale revolution came along, then you just had a gargantuan expansion of supply. And they were like, wait a minute, we don't need to import anymore. And then some of the kind of entrepreneurial guys were like, there's enough to export here. We can liquefy this. We can export gas to the whole world. And in the space of just 8 years, probably less than 8 years, the US went from being a net importer of gas to being the world's number one exporter of liquefied natural gas. That's quick.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And with that comes great riches.
It does. Yeah, if you can capture that arbitrage, you know, you're buying at Henry Hub, you're liquefying for a fixed fee, and you have, you know, your bunker fuel costs or the cost of transportation, the cost of freight, the margins on selling into Europe and into Asia now are just so absolutely phenomenal that those costs are nothing. And, you know, these companies are making hundreds of millions of pounds a year.
So now let's focus on the demand side. Let's start at the beginning. What is gas used for? Let's just focus on Europe, for example. What's gas used for in Europe? And how is that changing with decarbonisation?
Yeah, so there are three main demand applications for gas. So you have your space heating. So when you turn on your boiler and heat up your radiators, and like cooking is kind of part of that. So that's kind of residential and like commercial units that use gas for the same thing, for heating. So like residential and commercial. And then you have the industrial side of things, so like steel smelters. And gas is also a feedstock for making fertilizer. So you have the kind of industrial applications. And then you have power generation, so burning gas in typically a combined cycle gas turbine, which generates electricity by using the gas to turn the turbine and, you know, produce electrons.
I guess the first thing to talk about is that when we were burning a lot of coal 30 years ago and before that, we weren't burning much gas for power generation, but now gas generation is a major part of the generation mix. And so what are the assumptions about that going forward? What does that look like in the world of decarbonisation?
Yeah, the share of gas in the power mix, it changes like from day to day. It's very kind of flexible power source. So you tend to find the gas generation ramps up when wind and solar die down, and then it will ramp down again when there's production from renewables. So decarbonization and the rapid penetration of renewable variable output renewable sources is having a major impact on the demand outlook for gas in the power sector. But decarbonization more broadly affects those other sectors too. So like heating and industrial uses of gas, they also get affected by decarbonisation. So obviously the push to electrify heating with heat pumps, with e-boilers, that transfers the gas demand from the gas grid to the power grid. So you're going to have more power demand. And the idea is that you can increasingly, it's easier to meet power demand through renewables than it is finding like green sources of fuel like hydrogen to heat your home. So the electrification of heating is also has a major bearing on gas demand. But like the power sector is where you can really see visibly just how the onset of wind and solar is affecting gas demand. Because, you know, I ran some numbers in Energy Flux, and on kind of a pan-European basis, then the amount of gas that's being burnt in Europe for power generation, just on a kind of pure volume level, like the volume of gas that's being burnt for power generation, is at a 19-year low. So it's almost at like a 20-year low over the first, I did the analysis in July. So I compared January to July, going all the way back as far as I could find records for, and the amount of gas being burnt across Europe now is a 19-year low. We never burnt less gas over those months of the year since, you know, like before like Gordon Brown was prime minister. You know, it's like we're going back quite a long time. And the reason for that is twofold, really. One is like the massive onset of renewables. So like loads of wind and solar coming onto the system, just like reducing the overall need to burn gas to produce, to meet like the demand that's on the system, but also demand being lower as well. So like macroeconomic growth in Europe is not particularly strong and demand is quite low. And you know, like the need for electricity is kind of actually quite a lot lower than it has been over the preceding years. So like lower demand, more renewables means less gas in the power sector.
What does supply and demand globally? I mean, is number go up or number go down question, which is of course perilous. But what do the supply and demand characteristics look like going forward then? Because is the shale revolution still expanding? Are we getting more and more shale? Is LNG as a proportion of global gas getting bigger? And is demand in Europe getting smaller? I mean, What's generally is your assumption around the next few years? And I want to talk to you about volatility as well, because we should probably do a post-mortem on what happened over the last couple of years and then what we expect to, the fundamentals of the gas markets look like going forward. But let's start with supply and demand. So is Europe generally going to be consuming less demand going forward? And is the US generally going to be exporting more shale?
On the macro level, then arguably, yes. So, you know, the US has... Yeah, it went from a standing start in 2016 to being the world's number one LNG exporter on the basis of like massively, almost infinitely expanding production of shale gas. And they plan to double, again, the total amount of liquefaction capacity, their ability to export gas to the world over the next sort of 6, 7, 8 years, wow. Which is just an absolutely gargantuan hockey stick curve of export capacity. And that's all predicated on the basis that these shale basins will just keep producing more and more and more and more cheap gas. And there's a bit of a debate around whether that's a credible assumption to make, because obviously it is a finite resource. But at the same time, innovation has always surprised us, you know, the humanity's ability to get more out of less is just seems to be almost bottomless. And that's why we have so much shale gas in the first place. So it's kind of an open question, like how much more productive can these shale basins be? And, you know, the guys who want to invest in the liquefaction plants are banking on them being extremely productive for, you know, because these plants have like 20, 30 year economic life. So you're banking on the gas being there to actually put into the big fridge and then liquefy and export it at all. And then in the importing regions, then yeah, you've got Europe, which is demand growth is incredibly weak because Europe is, you know, on a kind of very broad basis of leading the energy transition. So trying to, you know, use less fossil fuels, use less gas, produce more renewables. And, you know, so demand for gas is in theory on a kind of like a downward trajectory in Europe, although it's a very bumpy outlook at the moment, because, you know, wind and solar do need flexible power sources to balance out that variability in supply. So, you know, like gas will be very much a central part of the European economy for a very long time. But on a kind of like macro level, then the demand outlook doesn't look particularly strong, the growth in Europe. Whereas in Asia, they're still using huge amounts of coal, and displacing that coal from those economies is, in theory, an opportunity for gas to, you know, come in and be like a kind of cleaner power source, a cleaner feedstock for like the economic needs of what is like the world's most rapidly growing region. It's like kind of like Southeast Asia. So like that's where all the economic growth is. And so the gas industry is really banking on Asia as being the big growth engine, particularly for LNG exports, because Asia is kind of structurally short on gas. You know, they're not big producers of gas, and so they need to import the gas from somewhere. And so the kind of investment case, if you like, in LNG is based on there being big growth story in Asia.
Let's talk about volatility, because this winter just gone, thinking through the lens of the power market in Great Britain and Europe, there's been suppressed power, baseload power prices now for a while. This winter was fairly mild, but we saw a couple of gigs less peak demand on the system. Yeah, I think the market's been quite surprised how little volatility there's been in gas markets. And essentially, it's gas and carbon that still sets the price in power markets in most of Europe. And so my question, if you can pull out your crystal ball, is the volatility coming back in gas markets, and therefore will it come back in power markets?
I'd say probably yes, because what's happening with the short-term outlook for gas is that it's being driven by competing narratives. And narratives are very important, because the way that gas prices are formed on these very liquid trading hubs means that sentiment is driving the way that prices move as much as like the fundamentals of supply and demand. So the fundamentals are bearish, because for the reasons I explained, you know, the renewables explosion in Europe and the UK included is, you know, it's really kind of pulling the rug out from underneath the demand story. But on the supply side, there's huge uncertainty, because obviously Russia's invasion of Ukraine saw a massive decrease in the amount of pipeline gas coming from Russia into Europe, which was replaced by liquefied natural gas. And in fact, the last remaining entry point for Russian gas into the EU through Ukraine is going to be shut on the 1st of January 2025.
What's that?
There's this place called Sudza, which is actually in the Kursk region of southwest Russia, and at the moment, right now, we're recording on the 14th of August, and I think that the Ukrainian forces have actually they've mounted a military incursion into Russia, and they're occupying part of Kursk, and they're occupying the region around the Sudza gas metering station and the compressor station, where the gas goes from Russia into Ukraine and onwards into the EU. So Russian gas, on the whole, used to meet around about half of European gas demand through the Nord Stream pipeline under the Baltic Sea and through other routes through Poland, plus the routes through Ukraine. The Nord Stream pipeline was taken out through an explosion in 2022, which was just, we've got to make a film about that, because that was just unbelievable. The detonation of a subsea explosive device on a massive subsea gas pipeline, unbelievable. That took out that pipeline, and Russia also chose to stop exporting gas to Europe through pipeline that goes through Poland, and a lot of the Ukrainian gas transits have stopped. So what remains of Russian gas comes into Europe through Ukraine, through this Sudza point, where there's like a lot of conflict at the moment, and there's another pipeline that goes into Turkey under the Black Sea, that's called the Turk Stream pipeline.
So Europe's still buying gas through Ukraine from Russia?
Yeah, but it's only about 5% of total European imports of gas, or consumption of gas, I should say. So about 5% of Europe's gas comes through from Russia through Ukraine still. And they're actually, you know, lobbing grenades at each other over the top of this compressor station, which pumps the gas from Russia into the Ukrainian gas transit system and onwards into Slovakia, Austria, and the rest of Europe.
Wow.
But it's only 5%. And when the Russian forces were kind of repelled and the Ukrainians took control of this compressor station, then the markets went crazy, because they thought, we're going to lose this supply. And so the price of gas on like the main European gas trading hub, it leapt by, you know, about 10 or 15%, even though we're only talking about the loss of 5% of all of Europe's gas supply. So this kind of speaks to the problem that we have with these very liberalized trading arrangements in Europe for gas, which is that they're very much driven by sentiment. And we also have this other problem, which is, I would argue, excessive speculation on the future price of gas. One of the pieces I've been digging into a lot in Energy Flux recently is, how much speculation is there in the gas price?
Okay, what does speculation mean?
Okay, so speculation is essentially financial investors who do not physically deal with gas. They don't handle gas. They don't produce gas. They don't have end supply agreements with consumers of gas. They're not utilities. They're just, you know, money managers. They come in, they take a financial position in the gas market, and they place a bet on, is the price going to go up or is it going to go down? And they do that by going long or going short. So you can buy these futures contracts on the main trading hub, which is called, it's called the TTF. It's the Dutch Title Transfer Facility. And it is by far the most liquid trading hub in all of Europe. And it's the benchmark for that region, for that reason, because so much gas is traded on TTF that it kind of sets the price across the whole of Europe.
A bit like the Henry Hub, but in Europe.
Yes, yeah, like Europe's Henry
in the Netherlands somewhere.
Yeah, so they're physically settled contracts, but it's a virtual trading arrangement. And the fact is, you can roll over your exposure on TTF from 1 month to the next. So that means that you can speculate.
So you never have to take delivery of the actual cargo or the actual gas.
Right. So that allows you to speculate on the future price, because you can take positions, roll them over, close them out. And with all the volatility that we've seen, all the changes of the supply and demand that we've seen because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, then these massive spikes in price are just like massive money-making opportunity. If you can come in and you have big pockets, deep pockets, and you can, you know, take positions on the future price of gas worth, you know, millions of euros, then you can, you know, double, triple, quadruple, 10x, 20x your money, depending on like how you kind of manage your risk and how you calculate your kind of on-ramp and your off-ramp. And I think that, like, certainly from the conversations I've had anecdotally, then there's my understanding is there's a lot of US hedge funds and Asian investment funds coming in, just taking purely speculative positions on TTF, you know, betting that the price will go up or go down, and then closing up those positions, extracting all the profit and repatriating it for their clients. And I've got some figures about just how much speculation is going on. And I think you'll find it quite surprising, because if you look at the amount of speculative contracts that are traded on TTF, at the current rates of about 40 euros per megawatt hour for a unit of gas in Europe, then there's about 25 billion euros of speculative capital sloshing around in the gas futures. That's a lot of money. And like the speculative component of TTF, it just absolutely dwarfs the amount of actual physical gas that's being bought, sold, and piped through the Netherlands. So if you'll bear with me.
But don't it, before we jump into that, don't they provide a market service? Aren't they liquidity providers?
Yeah, they do. So I should probably, let me rewind a bit, okay? I'm not like some anti-market zealot.
Yeah.
Right, I don't think markets are bad and speculation is bad. It's like, it's almost like a philosophical question. So yeah, speculators come in and they provide liquidity. And I will be the first one to acknowledge that the most volatile market is an illiquid market. Yeah, one that doesn't have any speculation whatsoever, and it's purely based on like the physical traders. They tend to be very volatile markets. But the philosophical question is, at what point does enough speculation become too much? And there's no real clear answer around that. But I would kind of posit that the situation that we have around speculation on TTF is so phenomenally large that we've gone from the enough place into the too much space.
Infinite bid.
Well, I don't know. What is infinite bid? What is that?
I guess it's just a wall of money that prevents prices going below a certain price.
Yeah, I mean, you get a lot of herding behavior. You know, you got like big capital coming in and moving the markets, because it's gone from a point where speculation just provides a service, provides, you know, a willing counterparty to somebody who's trying to manage their risk. You know, so you're a utility, you want to lock in your prices next year and not be exposed to the vagaries of what's happening with the wider market. You can go short in 2025 because you've got like length on your books now. That's very, that's like genuine risk management, that's like genuine trading. But the great thing about European regulations is that we know exactly how much trading is quote unquote genuine by like risk management entities who are managing their risk, and how much of it is purely speculative, because there's a transparency obligation placed upon traders on TTF to disclose their net positions. So every week we know how much traders have gone long, how much they've gone short, what the net position is, and how that changes week to week. So we can monitor whether the market is, you know, becoming increasingly bullish or is becoming bearish based on the way that 25 odd billion euros of speculative capital is positioning itself, is sloshing into long positions or out of short positions.
And I've got a feeling you're about to pull out some numbers.
Yeah, I don't go into that in my trusty journalist notebook. So I've got some figures for you.
All right, let's do the figures.
Yeah, okay. So TTF speculation. So you can look at like the amount of contracts that are open at any given time. That's the open interest on TTF.
And if you're listening to this and not watching, Seb's just pulled out a very pretty little notebook with some scribbles in it, which we're rather excited to see what's in there.
Yeah. So if you let's imagine you got open interest, right? That's like the kind of the amount of people who are bidding in the market, like bids and offers. And it's normal in a commodity market for that to be, in terms of like the volume of the commodity, greater than the amount of underlying physical commodity. It's normal. Like you want to have a bit more speculation than there is actual supply and physical demand of the stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's what allows you to have liquidity. So in like the, like we've got various like hubs, regional trading hubs around Europe. Like there's the PSV hub in Italy. There's the PEG, the PEG hub in France. There's the NBP, National Balancing Points, in the UK. These are all like regional local gas hubs. They all have between one and three times as much liquidity in the financial markets, the financial instruments, as they do the underlying commodity.
Okay. Yeah?
So like one to three times, let's say, for every unit of gas that's bought and sold in the UK, about three units of gas traded on NBP, right? And in Italy, it's about one or two, whatever. On the TTF, it's nearly 18 times. 18 times more liquidity on the hub than there is gas actually being traded. And that's more than any other commodity I could find. So in like coffee, for example, you can like trade coffee futures on the Intercontinental Exchange, which is one of the major exchanges. You can trade Robusta coffee futures, type of coffee. It's about 2 times open interest. On the London Metals Exchange, you can trade futures in tin and aluminium, and there's about 5 times open interest. On Brent, Brent, like the benchmark crude, it's 14 times open interest. Open interest is 14 times the underlying commodity. On TTF, it's nearly 18 times. So it's like you could say, so for every molecule of gas that I burn at home on my stove, that molecule of gas has been bought and sold on average 17 or 18 times before it's delivered to me. And every participant is looking to get value from that trade. So that inflates the price. And we can actually even measure the extent to which the speculation is influencing the price.
I'm really glad we're having this conversation. I just don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing. I think the assumption is that it's like a zero sum game, right? Which is that every transaction that happens on top of that base unit of commodity is adding up to a premium on it, right? Which I think is increase the cost to the general end consumer is the idea. But I guess if you think about financial products, say you think about the derivatives market in equities, or the biggest market in the world, the bond market, and everything around that, you'd probably find that defining open interest is a very difficult thing to do, right? But you'd probably find that there's an equal number of non-physical transactions or volume, maybe even more, on those markets. And is that a good or bad thing? I don't know.
There is a healthy amount of speculation, but it's not just about like how much open interest is there, because the regulations allow us to see of that total open interest, how much of it is purely speculative and how much of it is being undertaken by the genuine physical players who need to hedge their risk, who need to hedge their exposure. So the Dutch gas market, and this is all figures from the European Securities and Markets Authority, and they issued a ruling recently which had all the figures in it, and I'm just quoting from that. So the Dutch gas market, the size of the market is 167 terawatt hours per year. That includes all the gas that's being produced domestically, the pipeline gas coming in, going out, and the amount of LNG that kind of comes in to the Netherlands through these regasification terminals, 167 terawatt hours. The total open interest on TTF is in the region of 2,800 terawatt hours. That's where that 17-18x figure comes from. Mm. You divide one by the other, there's like 18 times more gas open interest on TTF than there is of like the physical gas underlying. So 2,800 terawatt hours. Of that, 640 terawatt hours is purely speculative. So the funds holding those contracts that total up to 640 terawatt hours are purely speculative traders. They are only in it to make a profit. 640 terawatt hours times the going rate on TTF, about 40 euros per megawatt hour, gives you the 25 billion speculative capital component of gas trade happening on the European benchmark gas trading hub. Now, we can see, like I said, like how that positions itself. So of that 640 terawatt hours, you can see how much of it is in long contracts, like speculating on the price going up, how much of it is speculating on the price going down. And if it's kind of more or less even, then, it's kind of like the hedge funds are hedging their bets, if you like. They're not pointing in a direction. But the problem...
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, I mean, some of this must be hedging positions by taking out contracts just to hedge, just end of day or whatever, to make sure your risk exposure isn't too big. So you could end up double counting a lot, right?
Yeah. So this counts all positions, right?
All positions net.
No. So I've added for this 650 terawatt hour, that's just like all of the positions added together. So the amount of speculative capital moving in the markets, some of it's long, some of it's short, right? Mm-hmm. What happens is that when of that kind of 640 or terawatt hours, if it goes like significantly net long, then you'll see the price going absolutely crazy up mm-hmm. you know, racing for the ceiling. And then same thing, like when it goes net short, like significantly net short, then, you know, that precipitates a massive drop in the price. And you can actually analyze, I've done regression analysis in energy flux. So what regression analysis is where you analyze the, you can actually quantify the relationship between two variables. So you've got movement in speculative capital and movement in price on the hub. And I've, over like the last 10 months, you can kind of get them side by side and you can quantify the correlation. I did this first in May. So for the 10 months leading up to May, there was a 53% correlation between the movement of speculative funds and movement of prices up and down on TTF. I did it again last week and it's now 63%. Sorry, no, it was 56% in May, 63%. So it's going up. So as more speculative capital moves in to TTF and takes these purely speculative money-making positions on the hub, then they are accounting for a greater proportion of the movements that we are seeing in the price of the actual gas itself. So I would say that speculation is becoming a greater moving factor in the actual price of the gas that is being used in the energy system.
And so what does that mean? What's the impact?
The impact is more volatility. It means that because like a lot of these, I'd say a lot of these hedge funds and a lot of like organizations that are investing in TTF futures just to make money, they're all powered by like big data, algorithmic trading. They are extremely attuned to geopolitical events. And so it's all about like I was saying about sentiment. Sentiment drives pricing. When you have a huge speculative component within the trading of any commodity, then it's like what you're doing is you're bringing the perception of the future into the present price formation. So you have all this kind of speculation about where prices are going to go in the future, which nobody can really know with any certainty, influencing how prices are being formed today. So that's why you see these kind of really outsized movements on TTF, because they are extremely attuned to like minor changes in what may or may not happen in the future. So that's why like when 5% of Europe's total gas supply is at risk of, you know, being cut off 6 months early because of, you know, Ukraine's incursion into the Kursk region of Russia, you see the gas price rising by double digits. It doesn't make sense because you're only talking about 5% of supply that was already going to be lost in 6 months' time, less than that, 5 months now. And yet it still manages to move the market double digits. The only way I think you can explain that is because you have this 25 billion euros of speculative capital betting on where the price is going, and this herding behavior where, you know, if you're a hedge fund and, you know, you see 24.9 billion euros of capital betting that the price is going to go up, you're going to do the same thing because otherwise you're betting against that. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. When all the traders take positions, then they have this influence on the price itself. So it's very much easier to kind of just jump on the roller coaster, go for a ride up the TTF train and make a lot of money on the way. And that's what we're seeing. Like the geopolitical events are having outsized impact on the price of gas because nothing has actually changed to the physical supply of gas in Europe. And it's the same with the Middle East, right? So I talked about Qatar earlier. Qatar is, well, until recently was the world's number one exporter of liquefied natural gas. It's now narrowly in second position, but it's still like a massive supplier of natural gas. All that gas comes out of the Persian Gulf. It has to go around the Strait of Hormuz, which is a very narrow waterway between, it goes like the very shallow waters just by Iran. And so it's very, very, it's like a choke point in transits. And all of the liquefied natural gas that comes out of Qatar has to go around the Strait of Hormuz. And it's always, whenever there's like geopolitical flashpoints in the Middle East, everyone worries about, is the Strait of Hormuz going to be cut off? Are we going to have this kind of chokehold by like gunboats stopping commercial freight from leaving the Persian Gulf, which would obviously impact oil exports from Saudi Arabia, from Kuwait, etc. And what's really, really fascinating is that when we've seen tensions become extremely heated in the Middle East and the geopolitical tensions rising and speculation about Hormuz becoming constrained, you've seen the gas price in Europe rising. But at the same time, we don't see the same phenomenon happening in oil price, even though like, you know, what is it, about a third of the world's crude oil is exported through the Strait of Hormuz. And so it's kind of like, well, so the gas market thinks that it's going to get constrained, or it could get some constraints. So we're paying a war premium, you know, the Hormuz premium is manifesting on TTF because everyone's speculating that it could happen. And so therefore prices have to go up. But at the same time, oil markets are not pricing in that same premium. So something doesn't add up. Why is geopolitics a bullish driver in gas, but it's not a bullish driver in crude? It doesn't make any sense. So my argument is that the speculative component on TTF is just out of control, and it doesn't actually reflect the kind of, it's just lost any connection with the fundamental supply and demand balances that should be governing fundamentally how prices are moving at any given moment.
Interesting. So you heard it here first.
Look at it this way, right? So the price on TTF, it hit a low of 20 odd euros per megawatt hour in February. It's up 75% since then. What's actually changed in the supply demand balance of the gas market to justify 75% increase between February and August? Nothing has changed. If anything, like I said, of looking at how much gas is being burned in the European power sector,
demand's reducing.
It's like a 20 year low. And yet we're paying 75% more for wholesale gas. Why?
Yep. So let's talk about storage for a second. Where do we even start? I mean, how is gas stored? Apart from liquefied natural gas on ships, how is gas stored in Europe?
Yeah, so Europe has the world's biggest underground gas storage capacity, and it's massive. It can hold enough gas to cover European demand for months on end, and the level of storage is also, like, when you look at the kind of fundamental drivers like supply and demand, also the amount of gas held in storage, that's a massive driver of price as well. And we've got this situation where Europe has been filling gas because it got caught short in 2021 because of all the manipulation of the market happening because of Russia's pre-invasion preparations. It got caught short. They brought in regulations. Now gas has to be filled to, I think, 80% of capacity before the end of the gas year. So on the 1st of November, I think, I might have to check that. But yeah, so in the autumn, when like you go from the refilling period to the withdrawal season, on an aggregate basis, all of the storage facilities need to be 80% full across all of Europe. And they're well in excess of that already. Well, Europe is doing so well filling its gas storage facilities over the course of the summer when demand is low and prices are low, that, you know, we're going to be reaching what's called tank tops pretty soon.
Tank tops.
Yeah. No, not the kind of outdated fashion item. It's when the gas is at the top of the underground storage tank and you can't get any more in. That's when it's full. So when you hit tank tops, then suddenly Europe has literally nowhere to put the gas. And we're on course to do that like in early autumn.
Oh, wow.
And when that happens, then, you know, when the LNG vessel rocks up in like the Bay of Biscay and it's got a whole cargo to unload, if you're at tank tops, then it literally has nowhere to go and you've got to hold it on the ship. And that's a problem because the gas in liquefied form boils off. So we're going to see more and more of this because we're going to have a huge increase. And I don't know if you remember at the start of this, I talked about the United States doubling its liquefaction capacity. So the amount of gas it's putting on the water is going to double in the coming years against a fundamentally kind of bearish outlook for demand. And Europe getting to tank tops earlier and earlier in the year, then you're going to have these situations where, you know, there's nowhere to actually put the gas. You have end up using the vessels themselves as floating storage, and you can see there are you can see like how much gas is being held on the water, how many vessels are being used as floating storage at any given moment. And I expect that we'll see more and more periods where you're seeing quite large volumes of gas being held on the water because it kind of has nowhere to go, or the traders, they're kind of banking on the price, you know, rising. There being a bit of a what's called the kind of the like floating arbitrage. So you can float the gas into a more expensively priced month and sell it to get a little bit more money, or maybe cut your losses even if the price goes really low. So we'll see more of that happening.
So you've got demand destruction essentially via, well, deindustrialization in many parts of Europe and electrification and renewables, and then you have this the storage tanks, tank tops, that's my new favorite word. And then you have lots more LNG, in fact, a doubling of LNG capacity coming out of the US in the next however many years. And so the picture surely then for Europe looks like one of oversupply.
Yeah, it is. And also, like, Europe has massively increased the amount of regasification capacity, because one of the constraints after Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the loss of pipeline gas from Russia was that we actually couldn't get enough gas into Europe quickly enough, get enough LNG into Europe. But one of the bottlenecks was infrastructure. So there's only a certain amount of gas you can regasify at any given moment, and that's a function of how much regasification capacity you have. So one of the strategic decisions that was taken in the wake of the loss of Russian pipeline gas was to go on this massive regas capacity building spree all around Europe. And Germany went from having no regas terminals to having, I think they've got three now, and there are more in development. And so you've got this kind of huge increase in the ability to import LNG, which means that as European gas the underground storage of gas becomes full, then you kind of outsource the storage requirement onto vessels, and you can like kind of just moor them around, and then when the gas is needed,
flotilla of vessels coming over the Atlantic full of gas.
Yeah, well, they called it an armada. You know, it's kind of this thing going around, like the US saved Europe again. You know, this armada of LNG vessels going across the Atlantic, and you could see it on satellite images, like this stream of gas laden vessels heading towards Europe to kind of refill those depleted gas stocks.
We should probably come to your contrarian view. I mean, if you've got anything to plug, I'm assuming it's your Substack, and we've plugged that for you as well. Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
Yeah, so definitely, like, please head on over to www.energyflux.news, or just Google Energy Flux News and you'll find me. But I don't just do gas, I don't just do Energy Flux. I am involved in another project, and it's called eForward. And this is a really, really exciting, total change of pace, by the way. This is like a really exciting energy transition membership community. I'm a contributor to eForward. I write a lot of their news analysis articles. But the really cool thing about eForward is that it's a group of energy transition professionals in the UK from across the energy space, and they meet up every quarter. They have these in-person events where they debate and thrash out some of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition. I've been really privileged to speak at the first three events in Aberdeen, and we've got one coming up in September in Edinburgh.
Awesome.
And it's very cool. So if you want to get involved, then I'll invite your listeners to go to eforward.energy and check it out.
Wicked. Yeah, we'll check that out. Now to your contrarian view. What do you believe that probably most of the world doesn't believe?
So I've come in for a bit of stick on Energy Flux by pursuing this speculation story and sort of questioning whether this is really healthy and good for consumers. So I think I set out my contrarian view in the conversation, which is that I think we've kind of crossed that is there enough speculation to too much speculation place. And there are not many outlets, really any news outlets, that are asking that question or even taking that position. And it's not a very popular one. And there are a lot of kind of mainstream business news outlets that seem quite happy to carry sort of credulous commentary and analysis about, you know, oh, gas scarcity, we're going to be like scarce of gas, that justifies the price rises. So my contrarian view is that I take the opposite view.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I wish I had an opinion on it, but I just don't. I definitely don't understand it enough. And
I have my opinion, it's fine.
Okay. I want to be sitting on the fence about this one. Although I trust you've done your work and the numbers are phenomenal. Seb, want to say a massive, I've just noticed your green socks, actually. They're lovely. You've got a Seb sat here with cacti on his socks. Looks like you've been to the Permian Basin. Seb, want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast. That was awesome. We'd love to have you on again and talk more about, we didn't cover much, we covered everything, but not in much detail. And maybe we have you on again if you're up for it sometime in the next year when there's some sort of big gas event and we can find out what really happened.
I would love to. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Seb.
Thank you for listening to Transmission, a Modo Energy podcast. Transmission delivers conversations from industry leaders and experts exploring energy markets and the operations and technologies related to grid-scale battery energy storage. Check out our other episodes by searching Transmission wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the Energy Academy, our video crash course on how markets in Great Britain and ERCOT work, or head to modoenergy.com to see our written research. Thanks for listening.